the week of May 5th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 447, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Hello, Sperling.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great because you're wrong.
Wait, what?
I love correcting you. We made a little bit of an error last week talking about the box office. Endgame opened up. It made a ton of money and it helped all on its own, frankly, close the gap between 2019 and 2018 at the North American box office. Of course it did. It's a big film. Year on year, box office was down 17% before Endgame opened. Then by the time we recorded our show last week, it had lowered to 13%. So that 4% gap was reduced by Endgame alone. You actually twisted it and said it was down to just 4%. It's not there yet.
I said it was down to 3% because that was the
yes,
data
and that was wrong. That's wrong.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I pulled that from Deadline.
No, what you read was the amount it had dropped. You just messed up. That's all. But now today, as of May 5th, North American box office is down just 9.6% year to date from 2018. So from 17% down to less than 10%, mostly due to one movie. It's made, $2 billion worldwide. So no big surprise. But we just want to make sure we corrected that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a big article in the New York Times from Brooks Barnes about the haves and have-nots in Hollywood these days when it comes to the box office.
Who are the have-nots?
Yeah, good question. I think like Little would be a have-not, Universal with Little.
Well, it's just a single movie. I thought you were talking about studios being permanently not doing well. I mean, Disney obviously has 40% of the market now.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A big problem, but that doesn't mean other studios aren't scoring hits.
No, not at all.
Right. And of course, when studios don't score hits, people change jobs, whether by invitation or by somebody else's decision. And a lot of job shifting has happened at Amazon. Sharon Tal Iguado left her role as head of genre. At Sony, Amy Pascal has left after decades for the retirement plan known as a first look deal, in this case at Universal. And at Disney, Alan Bergman has been named co-chairman, and Alan Horn has added the title of chief creative officer. I want to be chief creative officer. Do we care about any of these? Do any of these matter to you? Are you excited by any of these or interested?
Well, I think it's interesting that Alan Horn went from Warner Brothers, where he was kind of unceremoniously pushed out. I mean, a lot of people thought, well, why are you getting rid of him? He's still very valuable. And he helped oversee the studio during some very profitable times.
Mm-hmm.
And he then kind of, after about a year, he wound up at Disney. And he has, you can see what he's done with Disney. They're doing quite well. But he was of retirement age back at Warner Brothers, and now he is really of retirement age. What's interesting to me is that he's going to become chief creative officer, which is almost, they may as well just say, Alan Horn is going off to be a consultant for us. We're now bringing in Alan Bergman to be the chairman.
Oh, so you see that as a demotion?
Not a demotion, but I think Alan Horn is taking a step back, knowing that they need to kind of groom the next generation.
All right. And of course, we know that at Cannes, you'll be headed to Cannes, won't you?
Yes, I will.
Yeah,
Ideally, next week, I will be doing the show from London en route to Cannes.
Yeah, you will, of course, be seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Quentin Tarantino film. No surprise there.
The only question was, would it be ready in time?
Exactly. So we're looking forward to that. And don't worry, I corrected you at the top of the show, but at the end of the show, you'll have a viewer email that will correct or at least clarify my opinions about the WGA and what's in their contract debating points. But before we get there, we're going to talk about a lot of other stuff. Tell us.
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are still talking about Avengers Endgame and all of its records. Michael is on a quest, really, to make the world admit that Thursdays really do exist. We'll explain why. Plus, we'll toot our own horns about a U.S. remake of a Korean comedy we called for early on. By the way, if any studio needs talent scouts, call us, okay? 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And as the chief creative officer over there, Mr. Horn, we're looking at you. Also, the Tony nominations came out and they pack more drama and excitement than the creatively weak season that just ended. We'll take a look and predict which shows will benefit the most from awards and the chance to perform live on TV. On Inside Baseball, we're glad to report the issue of excess executive pay is finally gaining traction in the wider media. Yes, inequality was always an issue, but now it's one that people might just care about enough to make entertainment conglomerates change their ways. Okay, not really, but you know, a fella can dream, can he? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on how much more money Avengers Endgame the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's where we pull our main information. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Deadline Hollywood, The Numbers. I like that website a lot, too. And of course, major newspapers like The New York Times, The LA Times, The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, you name it. You are listener and the number one.
Well, I just want to point out before you even begin, I was right. Okay. I told you
genius
that Avengers Endgame in its second week would have a ginormous drop. That again, sure enough, over 50%, which means it only made a bajillion zillion dollars.
That's right. It dropped 59% at the North American box office. And yes, after the film became the second highest grossing movie of all time, it began to slow down.
The sky is falling.
That's right. Avengers Endgame is the number one movie around the world. Last week, it made $544 million worldwide. In fact, it made more than that. But I'm saying last week because I added in the North American box office from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, which was about $116 million. This movie made $116 million in North America during the week. During weekdays. That's how popular and big this film is. So when you're talking about how much money it made last week, you could just look at the weekend box office, or you could add up all 7 days because that's where it made money. Why ignore Monday through Thursday? But anyway, we don't know what it made during the weekdays around the world, but the final box office total does reflect all of that income. So over the weekend plus North America's 7 day span, it made $544 million. Worldwide, its total is now $2.188 billion. That's a lot of money. And as we said, it's the fifth film in history to gross $2 billion.
And it did it the fastest, by the way.
Well, of course. It passed Titanic to become the second highest grossing movie of all time. Take that, James Cameron.
Now, it took Titanic 5,233 days to actually surpass the $2 billion mark. That must be after it, like, you know, came out, a re-release or something like that.
Well, and you're ignoring the fact that that means it ran in theaters forever. It showed tremendous legs. It's not like it took so slow and long a time. No, it just made a ton of money. It stayed in theaters for 6, 8, 9 months and then came back again. I mean, that's the remarkable thing.
Even if it stayed in theaters for a year, that would be 365 days.
Right, but you've just ignored all the dates it wasn't in theaters. You just added in, I mean, you just foolishly added in this, reissue stuff. That's all. That's silly. It's a silly comparison. What you should do is count the days it was actually in theaters as opposed to the time span from when it first debuted to its reissue.
Well, that would require me to do a whole lot of math and then go find
all
those
sources.
What is
it with you and math? It took a long time for Titanic to make $2 billion, certainly longer than Force Awakens, which took 55 days, or Avengers Infinity War, which took 49 days. This is how long it took these movies to hit the $2 billion mark. Avatar took 47 days. It actually had actual midnight screening. So I went to see, was it actually 48 days? But no, it's actually 47 days, looking at the box office chart. Endgame took 11 days. So, and you mentioned ticket prices. Yes, in Titanic's time, the ticket price in North America average was $4.59. In 2018, the average ticket price was $9.11. So it's practically doubled.
And wait, so Titanic was $4.11.
Yes, Titanic was $4.59. And today, in 2018, the average ticket price is $9.11. So the ticket price in North America has pretty much doubled since the days of Titanic in 1997, I believe. So it's about 20 years.
Yes, it was. 1997.
Yeah, about 20 years. And so, but it doesn't still. 11 days is awfully fast.
I agree.
It surely is. One more thing was that it needs about $700 million to pass Avatar and become the highest grossing movie of all time. People are saying, will it do it? Will it do it? Given those weekday grosses, I don't see how it can't. It's clearly going to slow down.
I agree with you. I haven't seen it yet, so I'm going to go see it. My daughter has seen it twice. This movie will pass Avatar. In my opinion, it will pass Avatar.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to fall off a cliff. You joked about the big second weekend drop, and it dropped 59% because it made so much money. But I think it's going to have a good hold on its third weekend. The doorman has seen it once. He wants to take his son, and they can't find a screening that's free when they want to actually go. They haven't been able to do that yet. They're going to try to go this week. That'll be his second time. I hear this. I know a lot of people who haven't seen it.
My joke was merely about the fact that, oh my God, it dropped 60% and still made $544 million.
Right. Among other fun stats, on IMAX alone, it has made $170 million. 3D wow. ticket sales account for almost $1 billion of the total gross. Given how modest that is in North America, just about 20% of the total, and that's probably been dropping ever since opening weekend, that's a lot of money overseas.
I agree. Well, of course, China accounts for a huge portion of that, I'm sure.
It does indeed. So Avengers Endgame is the number one movie around the world. Last week, it made $544 million. At number two around the world is a romantic comedy set in the world of politics, starring Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. It's Longshot, $13 million on its opening weekend.
I think a lot of people went to see that on Sunday, believing that it was a replay of the Kentucky Derby.
who knew just bumping into another horse would disqualify you? I had no idea.
I knew that you had to stay your line. I did know that. But yeah. I mean,
I guess I assumed they jostled each other every once in a while.
Yeah. I saw Seabiscuit.
Yeah. Here's the biggest shocker for me of the box office this week. At number three around the world is Capernaum, an incredibly serious, you know, somewhat hopeful at the end, but really tough, strong, terrific movie. It grossed $13 million this weekend. $13 million. It has made $40 million worldwide. It has become a smash hit in China. It has made $25 million in China. This is really a tough independent film. It made about $1.6 million in North America.
Worth seeing. Oh, I mean, I know that people have problems with it.
It's a great movie. It's one of my favorite films of the year. I don't have any bloody problem. What idiots do you speak to that have problems with it?
You know,
it's one of the best reviewed, best films of the year. It's on all sorts of best critics lists. If there's an individual you spoke to that doesn't like it, that's nice. It's still one of the most acclaimed films of the year. It's a terrific movie. There's no problems with it.
And
one of the great child actor performances you can imagine, directed by a woman. And to have it make $25 million in China is kind of mind-blowing.
And I believe it's from Lebanon, right? And it's about a Lebanese boy, young boy. I think he's like maybe 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And he's suing his parents to not have any more children.
Because they're such bad parents. And he spends most of the movie basically on the streets struggling to survive, half the time dragging a small little baby around with him. It's just heartbreaking and tough and terrific. One of the great child performances. Ugh. And to see it making that much money in China, full credit to them. You want to look at a territory, a market that is really international, that watches movies from all over the world. China watches Bollywood movies. They watch Korean films. They watch this film from Lebanon and North American films like everyone else in the world. They are more international in their film going than the United States is right now. And they're perhaps than any other country in the world.
And I should point out that in China, after Hollywood movies, the largest block or largest box office winners are Indian films. Mm-hmm. So it's not domestically produced Chinese films that kind of take up the slack or kind of come in second. No, it's Indian films.
Yeah, no, that is just terrific. So at number four around the world is The Intruder. That made $11 million on its opening weekend, which is great because it only cost $8 million to make. It's a low-budget horror flick, sort of akin to The House of Blum. At number five is Ugly Dolls, another attempt to counter-program. They waited two weekends and they thought, okay, Avengers Endgame will still be making a lot of money, but people will have caught their breath. They're ready to maybe watch an adult romantic comedy like Longshot, or maybe an animated film for kids, little kids, like Ugly Dolls. Didn't work, really. These movies underperformed. I don't think it's because they opened up the second weekend of Endgame. I think it's just because they don't really deliver. That's probably the true thing here. I don't think if they opened up 6 months later or earlier, they would have done that much better. You never know. But in this case, I wouldn't blame them for doing this counter-programming. I think it was an okay move, just didn't pay off because the movie itself didn't deliver. But Ugly Dolls made $9.4 million on its opening week. And number six is The Curse of La Llorona, another low-budget horror flick. That passed the $100 million mark, so good for them. Where are my notes? I thought I couldn't find any notes. We'll end up together. That's right. This film, Pathé, so maybe it's French. Yes. It must be a French film. It's called We'll End Up Together. Clearly, the English translation does not do justice to the French version. I struggled to figure out what it's about, but I didn't have any luck. Well, whatever it is, it had a pretty strong opening in France, I assume, of $7 million. That's a good opening for that territory, for that kind of film. So congrats to them. And if you know what this movie is about, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail like Alan Horn will be doing as soon as our show is over. That number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter. We're at showbizsandbox is our handle. And we are also on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
Now, we've got a link to the entire chart in our show notes, but skipping down to two more new entries. At number 12 is Always Miss You. This is a Chinese romance about a woman who's had a string of failed relationships and finally finds the right man. And then that high school crush comes back into her life. What is she going to do? This weekend, it made $4.7 million. It's at $15 million and counting, but it was new to me, so that's why I'm mentioning it. And then skipping down to number 14 is Inseparable Bros. It's a Korean comedy or a comic drama, really, about two best pals. One is a jock and the other is disabled and in a wheelchair, but super smart. They're best friends. It's based on a true story. And I am certain, based on the trailer, I am certain this film is heartwarming. I just know it. $3.2 million on its opening weekend. The guys who did The Inseparables will probably remake it. And they do have the closing night film of Cannes, which sounds insufferably heartwarming as well.
Oh, wait. So this movie is the
No.
Oh, okay.
This movie's okay. In. I'm just saying the guys who did the French film, The Inseparables, which I didn't like, will probably, remake it because it's so heart-tugging. And they themselves have a film that is the closing night movie at Cannes, which just sounds insufferable.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know. You know, look, the closing night film, it's always either something that is not good or something that kind of comes out of nowhere and wins the Palme d'Or. And so I this one looked like the former rather than the latter.
Yeah. So, you know, what happens? My birthday this year happened. We're recording on Monday, actually, even though we talk about the week of May 5th. So it's Monday, May 6th, which means May 5th was Sunday. May 4th was Saturday. May 3rd was Friday. And then The day before that, what day was that?
That was May 2nd. That would have been your birthday.
It was my birthday, but it was what day of the week?
Was a Wednesday?
No, not Wednesday.
Thursday?
Yes, Thursday. It was Thursday, which apparently all box office record keepers want to pretend doesn't exist. Avengers Endgame, if you look it up on thenumbers.com, it opened up on May 26th. No, it didn't. April 26th. No, it didn't. It opened on April 25th. It made $60 million on Thursday, which happens to be Thor's Day. All the more reason. It's named after Thor, the god of thunder. All the more reason to acknowledge it. And now when they talk about the records this movie has set, they said Avengers Endgame, it made $600 million in North America in a record 10 days. No, it didn't. It took 11 days. It was not 10 days. It took 11 days. It's still a record, for God's sake. And, you know, if the movie opened up on a Wednesday, they wouldn't pretend it opened up on Friday because they're familiar with the idea of a Wednesday opening. And they wouldn't just say, well, it made the money in 10. No, they would say then it was 12 days.
So well, there were some territories where it did open on Wednesday.
Of course, it opened up. What the hell are you saying? Thank you for that. It opens up at different dates all over the world. We know that. It opens up in Tuesday someplace, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Anything can happen. Movies can open up on a Sunday. That's not the point. The point is to not ignore the fact that this movie opened up on a Thursday. And it made $60 million on Thursday. And on Friday, it made $97 million, not $157 million. It's ridiculous that they're doing that. And now they're distorting records. They're saying, oh, it made this money in 10 days. No, it didn't. It did not. That is factually wrong. They have to stop this nonsense of pretending a movie that opens up on Thursday is just a quote-unquote preview. They're screwing everything up.
I think, you know what? You should write a piece about this and interview all of the heads of distribution at all the studios and ask why this is, and it should be published. Well, celluloid
the heads
junkie.
The heads of distribution aren't the ones doing it. They're not. Well, they're not deciding what they. It's Variety and Hollywood Reporter and Box Office Profit and Box Office Mojo and The Numbers and all the box office people.
But they're reporting what the studios report to them.
The studios told them it made $60 million on Thursday. They didn't hide that fact. They didn't they didn't lie and say the movie opened up on Friday and pretend and close their eyes. Everybody knows when the movie opened up, but they, for some reason, want to ignore the fact that Thursday counts as an actual day of box office. I know some studios want to bulk up their Friday numbers and throw in the Thursday numbers, and they're like, well, you know, we want to have a big opening day as big as possible. Tough. Do you want to have a big opening day? Open up on one day. Or start midnight screenings on Thursday at midnight, 12:01 a.m. Or do it on Friday at 12:01 a.m. Do whatever you want. But if you open up on Thursday at 5 p.m., that's when your movie opened. You made $60 million on Thursday. Is that a record opening day? And you're like, well, Endgame should have a bigger... you know, that's your decision. I don't care where or when you open up your movie or what time of day. But when screenings start, that's your choice. But they do not have a choice when you're the New York Times or the Variety or the Numbers to pretend it opened up one day when it opened up a day earlier, or to lie and say, oh, it made $157 million on its opening day. No, it didn't. That's factually wrong. And it matters because now we can't, it's hard to, we've been comparing for years now, 3-day, you know, movie grosses from 3 days to movies grossed in 4 days. What kind of nonsense is that?
Well, let me ask you this.
7 million people went to the movies on Thursday, April 25th in North America. 7 million people, and they spent $60 million seeing the movie. It opened on Thursday, April 25th, and that's a fact. And anyone who says differently is lying.
And you could take it up with Michael. He'll see you outside. Like, He's already rolling up his sleeves.
Exactly. It's frustrating. Oh, well.
Well, you know what's really frustrating? I had this great idea. Just like Roy Lee used to go to Korea, South Korea, and he would take these like horror films out of South Korea and Japan, and he'd bring them over to the U.S. The Ring was one of them, right?
Right.
And he would make a mint doing this. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to do the same thing, but instead of horror films, I'm going to do it with like action comedies.
Well, and you're doing it now, baby. You're picking them. You're calling them.
And you told us a while ago about the South Korean film about a bunch of cops who open a restaurant for a sting operation. And then they discover, hey, actually, they're pretty good cooks and their restaurant is really popular. They may have a hit on their hands. And we said, whoa, 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 back up. That actually sounds like a good idea for a remake.
That's right. And that's now it's happening. Extreme Job, that Korean comedy, is getting remade in North America starring Kevin Hart, the star of The Insufferables. Not The Insufferables. The Inseparables. Yes, so Kevin Hart is doing another foreign language film remake for the North American market about cops opening up a restaurant. In this case, it was a chicken restaurant selling chicken. And I'm like, they're going to remake it from North America. I have the title for them. I'm Hot Chicken. It's perfect. It's hot because like stealing, crime, theft. Hot chicken is a hot, trendy chicken thing. It's the perfect name for the American remake. Hot Chicken. Just telling you.
Well, if it's Hot Chicken, by the way, if they do name this movie Hot Chicken, all I can say is, seriously, people, call us. 888-567-SAND. Now, seriously, I know last week we mentioned that the Tony nominations were going to be the day after we recorded. But hey, now we actually know who they are. And I totally agree with you, Michael. I do think that To Kill a Mockingbird, it's just totally going to clean up this year.
And it did. It got the most nominations of any play. It just didn't get one nomination in particular.
Well, do you think that's because that one nomination would go to Scott Rudin?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No, they're not dissing Scott Rudin. No, they love Scott Rudin. He produces lots of shows, brings plays to Broadway, gives a lot of people work. No, there's no animus against Scott Rudin on Broadway. I mean,
do you think we're talking
like
about
right,
you know, To Kill a Mockingbird not getting best play?
Right. You've jumped forward into the middle of a conversation like you always do.
I'm impatient.
It was a weird weak season, but somehow the Tony nominations were bursting with suspense and intrigue. I swear to you, you went through these and think, wow, like this person didn't get it, but that person did. This show didn't, but that show did. So yes, when we talk about best play, the big news were the snubs. Some shows were guaranteed to be nominated. Everyone knew it and they weren't. And the two shows that are the biggest, big, huge hits are To Kill a Mockingbird and the limited run of Network starring Bryan Cranston. Both were guaranteed to be nominated for Best Play and they weren't. Now, why do you think To Kill a Mockingbird was not nominated? You think Scott Rudin?
Scott Rudin because of the whole lawsuit thing that he was going after.
Oh, well, that's different. I thought you meant him personally. So yeah, we reported on the show the fact that they were tamping down on productions in other parts of the country of an earlier version of the show. They had some other controversy, of course, just dealing with the estate of Harper Lee. So they've been in court multiple times while this show was getting ready.
Ironically, it's a play about a court.
Exactly. I think the reason it didn't get a nomination is the same reason Network didn't get a nomination. Network less fairly so. I think they just don't feel like new plays. You know, yeah, well, To Kill a Mockingbird, it is a new play, but it just doesn't feel like it.
Well, and I wonder if you know, and this happens sometimes at the Academy Awards where, you know, people say, well, I'm not going to, you know, vote for Steven Spielberg to be best director. Everybody else is going to do that. And then in the end, everybody says the same thing. And Steven Spielberg, and I'm just using him as an example here, he doesn't get nominated.
I there aren't enough shows on Broadway that you feel like you have so many good shows that you want to push one aside to vote for another. It's rare that you would have five great plays, perhaps, that you would want to pick. I think in this case, it was just a simple fact. I mean, they love the show. They love Network. They gave them both a ton of nominations. I think the only explanation is that they just sort of, like me, were like, oh, it just doesn't feel like a fresh new play. It's not fair, but I think that's what happened. The other one that was ignored, that probably hasn't gotten great reviews or great attention is Lucas Hanaf's Hillary and Clinton, which I also haven't seen, also produced by Scott Rudin, and also ignored.
And I did see Hillary and Clinton, and you know, it's solid. It's definitely solid. I would not have been shocked to see it nominated for Best Play at all.
Yeah, but I mean, you think about how big To Kill a Mockingbird is. This show is going to run for years. Network is going to close when Bryan Cranston leaves. To Kill a Mockingbird is on Broadway for years to come now. That and Harry Potter gross more than most musicals on Broadway. Two plays are grossing more than almost every other show on Broadway. Only Hamilton, The Lion King, and The Wicked grossed more last week at the box office. And the positions don't change much. You know, it's not like shows bounce up and down. So those are two of the biggest shows on Broadway. You know, they're right at the top of the list. You have to go all the way to the bottom where the last bottom seven shows are all plays, because plays tend to be in smaller houses and not make as much money as musicals. So they have ignored a show that is going to be a mainstay on Broadway for years to come. If Mockingbird had been nominated, I would assume it would have won. So it really has thrown things up in the air. So what are the other nominees?
Well, the other locks were UK imports, The Ferryman and Ink, but they actually did make the cut. So the Best Play nominees are Choir Boy, written by Oscar winner Terrell Alvin McCraney of Moonlight. Then you have The Ferryman, the most traditional play of the bunch, and the one that, I saw that. I think it could win. Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus. That is literally the title. Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus. In my opinion, and in yours, I think, Michael, lucky to be on the list. Mm-hmm. Written by Taylor Mack. Ink, which is a timely, you know, work about the press. What the Constitution Means to Me, Heidi Schrenk's unique work that's both passionately political and hopeful. And the winner is Michael Watt. Take it away.
The Ferryman.
Yeah, I agree with
you. Now that To Kill a Mockingbird isn't on the list, I think The Ferryman is a lock. I mean, Ink and Gary both got lots of technical nominations, so you can't rule them out. But it's hard to imagine voters love those two shows when they ignored the leads. Johnny Lee Miller is the lead of Ink, and he's terrific. And Nathan Lane is the lead of Gary. Those are central dominating performances. It's not like they're ensemble work. Those guys are really the heart of the show. So if they love those plays, those guys should have been on the Best Actor list, and they're not. So I think it's pretty clear now that To Kill a Mockingbird is out of the way that The Ferryman is going to win Best Play. You never know, but that's my bet.
Now, okay, so let's move on to Best Musicals. There were no snubs. You can't really snub poorly reviewed shows, so there is no way to feign, you know, any shock at all over not recognizing, say, Be More Chill, The Cher Show, my big, big favorite, King Kong.
Loved it.
Big, because it's, Head Over Heels, Pretty Woman, and Getting the Band Back Together. Wait, what about Tootsie?
Well, that's not a poorly reviewed show, and that got nominated. And it wasn't snubbed. Those are the shows that didn't get a nomination.
Yes. Got it. Okay. So the only question then was which iffy shows would be rescued by a nomination? Which ones are going to be rescued by,
well,
by
the, I think
a nomination?
The two shows
and
that,
the answer is, Michael, take it away.
Yeah. I think, you know, you had a bunch of shows that were on the bubble. The Cher Show could have been nominated. Be More Chill might have been nominated. And so you were sort of thinking, who's going to luck out and get that fourth and fifth slot? And the answer is The Prom. And Beetlejuice.
I think they only actually have the one Beetlejuice in the musical.
Oh, well, there you go.
Just once.
So the Prom is a show about Broadway stars. Sure, there are self-involved Broadway stars, but Broadway loves to laugh at itself as long as it's in on the joke. And the Beetlejuice I saw, it's not so bad, insiders say, which is hardly a polite compliment, but there it is.
And so the musical nominees, the real musical nominees, not the list I just read that I thought were nominees. Okay, here they are. Ain't Too Proud, which is the Temptations musical. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice only one time. Mm-hmm. Hadestown, The Prom, and Tootsie. And the winner is Michael, take it away.
Hadestown. Hadestown got every nomination possible except male lead, which isn't so telling since that actually is more of an ensemble piece. And the only thing most people didn't like about the show was, in fact, the acting performance of Reeve Carney. He was coached that way by them because they did the same performance with another actor off Broadway, so it's not his fault. But by God, that's it. So it got everything. Tootsie showed some weakness in the tech categories. It got no nominations for scenic design, lighting design, or sound design. I still think it's kind of close. But and I'm making the rookie mistake of ignoring the Temptations musical because I just didn't like it. You know, sometimes you get confused when you're trying to decide who's going to win because you see and you're like, I don't like that. So I just don't even think about Ain't Too Proud. But it got a lot of nominations pretty much everywhere it could. So clearly, Tony voters loved it. In my mind, the showdown is between Hadestown and Tootsie. But maybe it's between Hadestown and Ain't Too Proud. But you know what? The only vote that's cool is Hadestown. It has the cool factor. Ain't Too Proud and Tootsie are more traditional. Beetlejuice and The Prom don't have a chance. And Hadestown also has some great veterans being showcased. Patrick Page, Andre DeShields, and Amber Gray. So you've got the kids who want to vote for the cool show, and you've got the Broadway veterans who love to see one of their own get a great showcase late in their life, like Andre DeShields, who's in his 70s. So I think it's got a lot going for it, and it is the best reviewed show of the year, so I think it's going to win.
And so you're not tempted to pick Ain't Too Proud.
Oh, very nice, very nice.
Yeah, hey, how about that? Well, okay, so what about best revival of a play? Because sometimes you can spot a winner because one show gets the lion's share of nominations in other categories. This year, every show revealed a lack of love from voters in one way or another, so picking a winner is very hard, and the nominees are... Okay, so here we go.
All right.
My Sons, you know, the Arthur Miller, the lead Tracy Letts was ignored, and that's the main role. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the main role. The Boys in the Band, only one supporting nod despite an all-star cast. Burn This, Adam Driver was nominated, but not Kerry Russell. Mm-hmm. She did not get an acting nod. Torch Song, no acting nods at all. The Waverly Gallery, only one for Elaine May, but she's obviously the lead role. And the winner is, Michael, take it away.
This is very tough. I'm gonna go with the Waverly Gallery. It's really hard to call because of all the reasons you just outlined. But I think affection for Elaine May should win out. It seems the least flawed revival. Maybe I would have gone towards the Boys in the Band, but like no nods for any of the leads, all those famous guys. All My Sons has problems. They all have serious problems. So I think the Waverly Gallery was the most modestly successful run. The Boys in the Band was the biggest hit, but it's gone. They're all gone, actually, except for, you know, All My Sons and Burn This, which are going to close soon once their famous leads leave. So there's no winner to bet on to run for years and years or anything like that. That's going to be a win for Kenneth Lonergan in the Waverly Gallery, I think.
Well, okay, let me ask you this. Broadway saw only two musical revivals this year. Kiss Me, Kate, and Oklahoma, Where the Wind Comes Sweeping Down the Plain. Which is going to win?
Well, I like Kiss Me, Kate more, so of course Oklahoma is going to win by a mile.
Well, it has, you know, well, I don't know, Kelly O'Hara's in Kiss Me, Kate.
She's acting royalty, and of course she got a nomination for Kiss Me, Kate. But Oklahoma got the directing nomination.
You know what? I can't wait until the year when Kelly O'Hara gets nominated for actually going to see a musical. Like, she's in the audience and they're like, you know what? She's
not
the
Meryl Streep of theater. She's not that heavily, you know, wowed with nominations, but she's a terrific, one of the big stars right now on Broadway. So Oklahoma got a directing nomination. There are only five slots and you had seven shows and Oklahoma got one of them. Well, you could have nominated other musicals that didn't get a best musical nominee, but that was the revival that pushed its way into the directing category, unlike Kiss Me, Kate. Really, the only notable nomination for Kate was in choreography once you got beyond Kelly O'Hara's nomination. And that's due to the terrific second act opener, Too Darn Hot. It's almost worth seeing the show just for that second act dance piece. But Oklahoma got a lot of technical nominations. I did like Kiss Me, Kate a little bit more. I didn't love either of them, but absolutely no one is passionate about Kiss Me, Kate. Some people hated Oklahoma, but a lot of people clearly love it, and it's the bigger hit. So it's probably the safest bet of the entire night. You know, when you look at best play, best musical, best revival play, best revival musical, if I had to place money down, it would probably be best musical revival, Oklahoma.
You know, I didn't realize that Kelly O'Hara was in Kiss Me, Kate. Otherwise, when I was in New York recently, I probably would have seen it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and you might have seen Glenda Jackson and King Lear, but if you decided not to, I said, you know, it is quite long. And there was no love for that show. Everyone assumed.
Oh, my God. You read the reviews and people were like, oh, no.
Yes, yeah. And people assumed Glenda Jackson would at least get a nod. She was acclaimed in London for this performance. She just won last year the Tony for her performance in Three Tall Women, but no nomination for her here. Jeremy Pope is a cool story. He appeared on Broadway in Choir Boy, nominated for Best Play, and he's starring now in a supporting role in Ain't Too Proud, the Best Musical nominee. So both Best Play nominee and Best Musical nominee starring the same guy because Choir Boy shut down. But Jeremy Pope was nominated for Best Actor in a Play and Best Supporting Actor in a Musical in the same season. That's crazy. I don't know if I'm pretty sure that's never happened before. The closest I could come was Jeremy Jordan. He originated two roles in two new musicals in the same season.
I remember that.
That's really hard to do. He did it in Bonnie and Clyde, which then shut down. He'd already committed to that. And then he was able to jump over to Newsies, which he had done in Jersey and had become a great success and was rushing to Broadway and looked like he was going to miss that train. But because Bonnie and Clyde was such a flop, he was free and able to do that. So Jeremy Pope's accomplishment here is pretty great. Choir Boy is almost sort of a semi-musical. That's one reason why he got that role, because he's got a lovely singing voice. But very cool to be nominated for the Best Play and Best Musical of the year.
So you're saying that's a big deal?
That is a very big deal.
No, right. Well, if that's a big deal, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, maybe?
I think so. A quiet approach to the new edition of this, you know, this category.
Yeah, because I'm trying to change it up.
Okay,
you know?
I got it.
Because,
got it.
You know, Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the CBS News Division is saying, me too, but in a good way. It has trouble spots stretching from CBS This Morning to the CBS Evening News, and the network announced a string of changes. The result, women are key players virtually everywhere. Gail King hosts CBS This Morning with two new men, although Michael and I aren't any of them.
Nope.
So, yep. Can you believe it? But anyway, King is the king of that castle. Her former co-anchor, Nora O'Donnell, moves to CBS Evening News, becoming only the third woman in history to anchor an evening news show. Add in the fact that Margaret Brennan anchors Face the Nation while Jane Pauley is the face of CBS Sunday Morning, and you've got an unprecedented lineup of female stars in news. I see a discrimination lawsuit coming from some men. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's a big change. Hasn't happened before at any other network. It's cool to see. And we look at the producing credits on all these shows. You see a lot of women in power there as well. But let's not forget Diane Sawyer, Katie Couric, and now Nora O'Donnell. That's very cool. As some people mentioned, and of course, Connie Chung co-anchored the evening news with Dan Rather, forgetting to mention Barbara Walters. She co-anchored the evening news way back in the 70s with Harry Reasoner. So she was the first woman to co-anchor an evening news broadcast. Let's not forget her pioneering role in television news.
Now our next story. Do you hear the people sing? Well, in London, they won't be singing for about 5 months as the theater hosting the long-running musical Les Mis shuts down for serious renovations. You know, I don't think that rhymes. I don't think that second
keep going.
We're going to have to change that. Producer Cameron McIntosh is cleaning house in more ways than one. First, when the classic musical returns, they will be presenting a different touring production rather than the iconic original and more expensive version that has been in place for decades. Second, the entire backstage crew is being fired. That's right. Please don't come back when we reopen. Along with, by the way, half of the orchestra. Half of the orchestra will be joining the backstage staff. Have people become slipshod, taking for granted the luxury of a guaranteed job in the theater? Nope. But they are being paid very well, thanks to steady escalations over the years. Legally, Macintosh is treating the newly mounted version as, well, entirely new. Thus, they can wipe the slate clean, eliminate musicians who have received strong and growing paychecks for many years, and bring in new folk and new minimums, saving him lots of money. Indeed, one musician is believed to have been with the show since it opened some 30 years ago. Is this enough to make you want to man the barricades, Michael? In other words, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. Obviously, it's been running for 30 years. They're doing this to renovate the theater, and Cameron Macintosh is taking advantage of that to save money. And, you know, he's going to fire people who've been with the show for decades, never mind how many billions of dollars it's made, and then save a few bucks. So it's kind of unpleasant and nasty, but what are you going to do? One question, will this still be the longest running musical in history? Because is this the same musical? Legally, it's not. He's going to want to claim, hey, we just took a break and it's the same show. It's an entirely different design. It is not the revolving turntable design. This is the touring production, which I saw on Broadway, that version, which I didn't like as much. I liked the performances, but I did not like that touring missing of the turntable. That's the iconic way Les Mis became world famous. And if you're going to do a new version of it, why not do a real new version of it? This is sort of a tweak to save money on tour. They could have made a really radical new production of Les Mis. That would be fine, but they didn't. So it's a bummer. And you know what? When they do this new design, guess what? He doesn't have to pay some of the original people who created the show, like John Napier, who did the original scenic design and is one of the key creative talents. He did Cats, Les Mis, you know, some of the biggest shows of all time. So he's out. And he won't make a penny off the new revival when it opens up in the West End. That's another good reason why he did this. He can save money left and right. And if you want to read a good interview with John Napier, we have a link to that in our show notes.
Wait a second. There's no turntable stage in touring version.
Right.
That's
Les Mis, exactly.
Yeah, Hamilton brought the touring thing because that was the whole point. They had the turn. Yeah.
Well, Hamilton obviously inspired and a nod to Les Mis using the turntable, of course.
Yeah. Well, Sinclair Broadcasting has a new nickname. It's called The Little Fox. The media company has gorged on local TV stations and turned them into stealth Fox News channels, with stations forced to carry right-wing content posing as news stories, required to read, you know, the hosts there have been required to read opinion pieces and pretending it's their own point of view and so on. It's a little creepy, actually, as one viral video mocking the company for its Orwellian use of local news proved. I highly recommend looking that up because it is scary. Then they toyed with launching an official right-wing competitor to Fox News. Now, in further imitation of Rupert Murdoch's empire, Sinclair has snapped up their regional sports network from its new owners, Disney. Sinclair spent $10.6 billion on 21 regional sports channels like Fox Sports West in LA to go along with its 191 TV stations. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. Of course, money-wise, I think it's a big whoop. Disney had to sell it off. It's going to go to someone. And you can see Sinclair just following that Fox blueprint, you know, like making like Rupert. I was surprised to see bland comic Byron Allen involved in this. Byron Allen has been a smart media empire builder for a long time now. Sort of a low-key guy who's bought up cable channels, created channels, lots of different things. He owns a piece of the Weather Channel. Somehow he's a part of this deal as well. The subsidiary owns a chunk of it. It's dubbed the Diamond Sports Group, and Byron Allen's a player. Does he know how bad Sinclair is politically? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he may very well just be out for the Diamond Sports Group and then hoping that he can then take that and you know, spin it out somehow away from Sinclair.
Well, he's not going to be able to do that. They're the new owners of it. But yeah, no, he wants to make money is all what it boils down to.
Now, speaking of sports, YouTube joins Facebook as a serious player when it comes to sports programming. The website just snagged its first exclusive rights to 13 baseball games for North America. They'll also be able to show them on the MLB official YouTube channel and on YouTube TV when that launches later this year, both in the US and around the world, except for in 22 territories where existing MLB contracts are in place. This comes on top of YouTube getting rights to home games from US soccer teams, the LA Football Club, and the Seattle Sounders. Their baseball broadcasts will include MLB and YouTube content before and after the games, including YouTube stars to be named later. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's been happening for a while with Facebook and YouTube and other websites saying we want content. and sports is a great way to get them, bring in eyeballs. In 2018, the Major League Baseball YouTube channel generated 1,250 million views, and that was up like 30% or something from 1 year earlier. So wow. Clearly, people watch a lot of clips on YouTube, and now if you're going to want to watch a game, you're going to have to go, where the hell is it, and figure it out. Oh, it's on YouTube of all places, but that's where it'll end up. So this is the future, isn't it?
Yes, and you know, speaking of YouTube stars,
was interesting. PewDiePie, you know, commenting on baseball. Who knows what'll happen?
Well, Jake Paul lives around the corner from me, and he is somebody I can't even believe whose name I know, to be perfectly honest. And I guess he's been holding parties that the neighbors do not appreciate.
And oh, I saw that. I don't know why I saw that, but I did. Well, I'm ashamed that I saw that.
Well, you know, and I'm not saying that Jake Paul did this, okay? I'm saying that he threw a party and certain things happened at that party.
A woman reported being drugged at his party, according to CBS Los Angeles.
Correct. And they were all wound up in West Hills Medical Center. And I know that it's being investigated, but boy, it's like, it's really... shocking. When I told my daughter, I said, hey, you know, Jake Paul, this, she said, why would anybody go to Jake Paul's house? I was like, okay, then.
She's too busy watching TikTok. Keep going.
Exactly. A new governor means new chances to put your own people into place in key positions. Yeah, so where is my offer, for Pete's sakes? Anyway, so perhaps it's no surprise that California Governor Gavin Newsom is getting ready to show the state's film commissioner, Amy Lemish, the door after 15 years on the job. A record for the state, by the way. Still, her track record has been impressive. Lemish pushed for increased tax incentives in order to stop productions fleeing for rebates being dangled in front of them by other parts of the country and Canada. Lemish must also oversee decisions on who gets those tax incentives while encouraging local cities to remain film friendly. By all accounts, she's done a strong job. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to ask you. It's your backyard. Is this just, well, she's done it for 15 years, he's a new governor, he can bring some in fresh blood, or is he making a big mistake?
I have no idea. I wonder if maybe this was a long time coming, or if there was any, I don't think there's any malfeasance here.
No, suggestion of that. Don't, why even say that?
No. I don't think there is.
Then you wouldn't say, I don't think she killed anybody. I mean, why would you say such a thing? I don't think she beats her children.
Well, let's just check that off the list. Yeah, we can take it off the list.
Good Lord. I apologize, Ms. Lemish.
Okay, we now know you're not a, you know,
yeah,
a
keep
child
going.
Beater.
Keep going.
And murderer. I don't know whether it's a big deal or not. Maybe it's just time for somebody else to take over. Who knows? Maybe she's moving on to greener pastures. I don't know.
Okay.
I haven't read anything. Or, you know, I'm not a part of that world. Nor am I a part of the world of Empire. Nor is Jesse Smollett anymore, at least for now. The Fox TV...
No, that's not quite true.
That's not quite true. Which I'm about to prove.
Right.
The Fox TV network squared the circle when it came to the hit TV show Empire. They renewed the soapy drama for a sixth season and perhaps also placated the powerful cast without committing to what might become a PR disaster. The show's star, Jesse Smollett, is embroiled in lawsuits over his alleged plot to fake a hate crime. While the charges were dropped, Smollett still faces lawsuits from the city of Chicago. Nonetheless, the major stars of Empire want Smollett back, saying he faces no criminal charges, and hey, family is family. What to do? Fox? Well, they wisely punted. They aren't committed to bringing his character back yet, but they're leaving the door open by keeping Smollett on hold by extending his option. Another way of saying, you'll still make a little money off this. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a smart move. That's all I said. That was probably the right thing to do. Don't anger them by saying absolutely not. Don't bring him back on when he's still getting embroiled in lawsuits and you don't know what the heck is going on with this crazy situation. So I think it was a smart, savvy move.
Now, last week, we reported that Indian music streamer Gaana was boasting it had 100 million users on its platform at the freemium level with ads. So that's like, what, 0.00001% of the Indian population. Well, not to be outdone, its competitor JioSaavn said, you've got 100 million users? Ha! Big deal. We've got 104 million users. As with Gaana, they are... talking about monthly active users who access the music on a free platform with ads. Spotify, by the way, has 217 million users worldwide with 100 million paid subscribers. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's more like they have 100 million paid subscribers. The others have free people using it at the 100 million level. Spotify has 100 million paid. That's how far ahead they are. That's a lot of money. So I think it's a big deal. You know, there's a lot. It's a big market. It's just reminding us how big India is and how come everybody wants to be a player in there, because there's a lot of people there. And the growth of listening to music as everyone has mobile devices and gets a little bit more money, that's just going to grow and grow and grow. And Spotify has been growing. I saw a stat like 1 year ago, they were adding 20,000 tracks a day, meaning all the labels and people with access to Spotify who could just put up new music. 20,000 tracks a day were being added, about the equivalent of 2,000 albums, you know, if you figure 10 tracks an album. Well, now they say the rate is 40,000 tracks a day get added to Spotify, the equivalent of 2,000 to 4,000 albums every single day are added to Spotify. That's
and only half of them are Beatles reissues.
Beatles? No. The Beatles.
I'm kidding.
But the Beatles are famous for not soaking the market. They never did tons of reissues and repackaging. That's why when they finally put out like one, the compilation of greatest hits number one tracks, why it did so well, because they hadn't put out 47 compilations before and since then. No, they're the masters of not, screwing people over and just adding a new bonus track and making you buy the album all over again. So don't lump the Beatles in there. No way.
You try and make one joke.
Make it an accurate joke.
Well, when this next story, I read it and I immediately copied the link, raced to the show notes, and it was already there.
I'm fast.
Yeah, you're like sitting on your the show notes, like waiting for them to hatch. Now, we've talked a lot about this next story, the lawsuit over the hit TV show Bones. The producers and stars won a court case proving they'd been ripped off by a studio that cooked the numbers so profit participants would never get their fair share. And by cooked the books, man, did that arbitrator just... Yeah, that book was like, it's overdone, it's burnt. Okay, well, another judge has overruled the awarding of $128 million in punitive damages. It doesn't change the finding that Fox owes them $50 million in damages, just not punitive damages. They also owe interest and attorney's fees. The creatives insist the arbitrator's judgment should not have been questioned and will, of course, appeal. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It's just the latest stage. It's not going to end here. We'll have to find out where it ends up. And no matter what, they've been reaffirmed in the fact that the studio did rip them off, and they're going to get tens of millions of dollars for that reason.
That is very true. I mean, it was a shocking case when damages statement when it was announced. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see how it plays out.
I think you're right, but we won't have to wait for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Here's how they affect you, especially if you live in areas where moguls live. Your real estate prices are probably going through the roof. Why? Because, all of these media moguls can afford trillions of dollars for their real estate. Why? Because they're being paid a fortune. Michael and I have discussed repeatedly over the years how much top execs in the entertainment biz get paid. Okay, I've discussed it, and Michael has raged, really, but and scoffed and shook his head in dismay, and I think there was some fist shaking going on. Now, is the rest of the country beginning to catch up? A relative of Walt Disney speaks up, and Abigail Disney is her name, and she spoke up at a Disney shareholders meeting and insists no one on the planet deserves to be paid $65 million except for Michael and I. Bob Iger made that much last year, and guess what? He's not alone at all. The AT&T, the head of AT&T who owns WarnerMedia, Randall Stephenson, he made $29 million, 300 times the median employee's wages. Les Moonves, who's not even there anymore, okay, he made $47 million at CBS last year, $452 times the typical employee at CBS. Comcast, Brian Roberts, guess what? He made a measly $35 million, while NBC Universal head Stephen Burke, he made $40 million. And that's about, that last figure, 486 times the average employee. I could go on and on. I mean, Rupert Murdoch made $49 million last year, 726 times the amount that the average employee makes at Fox.
And Viacom, Bob Bakish. He only made a modest $20 million, but that was still more than 700 times more than the median employee's pay. So it's kind of amazing. It's fascinating. People are starting to talk about it. Candidates running for president are focusing more and more on the absurd disparity between CEOs and their employees. And that ratio is what really matters. In the 50s, CEOs might have made 30 times what their typical employee made. I can remember in the 70s when Lee Iacocca at Chrysler, a publicly traded company, when he was being paid $1 million, that was front page stories across the country, the outrageous money. Like the idea that a head of a publicly traded company would make that much money in 1 year was seen as obscene and absurd. But, you know, look where we are now.
Well, and a part of this, it's the same thing on Wall Street, by the way, where, you know, and I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying a part of this has to do with, hey, you know, Joe down the street is making $20 million. I better make $24 million. And investment bankers play the same game. Well, if you're paying him $30 million, you better pay me $35.
Right. Well, one of the great things the boards do is they say when they've got a CEO, they want to make sure they're competitive. So they want to make sure that they make the average of what other CEOs at typically sized companies make. So when somebody makes an extraordinary amount of money, that brings up the median average, and everybody else says, well, we got to match the median average. So it just ratchets up everybody's salary at the CEO level again and again and again by saying, well, we have to at least pay in the middle of what everybody else makes. And thus, when somebody gets $300 million that year, guess what? The average jumps up, so everybody gets a big pay cut, pay raise, and it just goes on and on and on. And of course, the CEOs sit on the boards of their friends and their neighbors, and their, you know, all these people pay each other money to sit on their own boards, and they all feed each other money, and they're all palsies. And of course, we fought this by saying, well, let's give them stock options. Then they'll be vested in how much a company, you know, grows rather than just their own salary. So yeah, that was great, and it seemed like it was a fix for a while. But now people say, I'll be paid a dollar. Y'all just take $1. Of course, they get stock options of tens of millions of dollars. And then that makes them focus on quarterly earnings and even, you know, doing things that will hurt the company long term, but it jacks up the stock prices when they're ready to bail out. So that is not a solution.
In the case of Bob Iger, I think, yes, does he care about quarterly earnings? Yeah, he absolutely does because that's part of his job. But I think it's safe to say he has cared about the long run too.
It doesn't mean every CEO doesn't do a good job or a great job, yeah. But there's no reason why employees working at Disney World make crap pay and Bob Iger makes an obscene amount of money. There's no reason for anybody on the planet to make $60 million a year.
And this all came out right as, you know, all the firing started to happen at Fox. So it just did not look good at all.
Well, sure. It doesn't matter. They're always firing people, you know.
Right, but not in the, you know, not by the thousands.
Right. So we've got the, you know, stories in one paper. Variety had a story called on executive pay called Because They Can. and this major feature, they did a major feature written by David Lieberman and Brent Lang. This is in an entertainment trade journal that is watching the industry, and it's sort of, you know, insidery, and even they are writing in a way that makes it sound more like you're reading the Jacobin or something. The bosses and directors of the world's largest media companies aren't going to win many popularity contests. They anger a lot of people, including investors, when they approve out-of-whack pay packages for their CEOs. Their lavish salaries and generous awarding of stock options to key leaders enrage politicians on the left and threaten to become a political issue in the upcoming presidential election. And they appear to have been oblivious to women's concerns as disclosures of sexual harassment and bullying at the companies they oversee piled up over the past year or so. Will the pressure of accountability rising? With the pressure of accountability rising, will things change? Not if you look at the latest annual proxy reports from the 9 companies on their watch list. So, you know, that's where we're at. And there's a related story about a bunch of companies that don't pay taxes. That was not media-centric, but, you know, it sure could be because there's Amazon and Netflix on the list along with a bunch of energy companies.
Yeah, it's, again, look up the documentary, We're Not Broke, and that'll just make you so mad, you'll be shaking your fist with Michael.
But we are sad, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I was really sad to hear about what I think you're referring to, and it's not the fact that I did not make $65 million last year, because that was kind of a foregone conclusion, but I think it's about actor Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca in Star Wars in almost all the Star Wars films until recently. He died of a heart attack at the age of 74.
Yes, he had mostly minor roles before the film. In fact, he was working as an orderly when he auditioned for the part. He got it because George Lucas needed someone who could be taller than Darth Vader. He was 7'3" at his peak. And, he got the role, did film Star Wars, went back to working as an orderly. You know, not a lot of other parts available for him. But over the years, you know, he made a life out of Chewie. He attended fan fests and conventions, appeared in 5 Star Wars films, climaxing with The Force Awakens in 2015. Then he had to retire from acting due to health reasons, and he was kept on as a consultant for the next Chewie, which was very sweet of them. So, you know, he made a lifetime out of playing Chewie. So, you know, You know, you got that one lucky break, make the most of it. A sweet guy by all accounts. So cool to see. And we can all.
Was it his voice? I believe it was his voice.
No, another person did the voice. He physically embodied Chewie.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I remember.
Just as Darth Vader was played by one person physically.
David Prowse. Yeah.
And another person, James Earl Jones, did the voice.
Yeah, you know, there was some behind the scenes footage of the first of the new stuff. So episode what, 4, 5, 6? It would be episode 7, and he did the growl and was like, "Wow, that's pretty good. He did a pretty good job of that." I guess he had a lifetime of practicing.
Yes, exactly. That makes me all the anger in the last Star Wars movie where, you know, the new gal comes onto the ship with Millennium Falcon, and suddenly she's the pilot. He's the co-pilot still. He's been on the ship for years, for decades, and he's not the pilot.
Decades, try centuries. He's 200 years old.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, he's older than everybody, and he's still the co-pilot and didn't get a medal at the end of Star Wars. It's all outrageous. And we'll just forget about the Star Wars holiday special, which I have actually seen.
Yeah, so have I. Boy. I saw it live. Boy, when it was, yeah, when it aired.
I'm surprised you didn't turn away in horror. I should turn away in horror from this letter that we got in our listener email.
From somebody named Joel Rose, who, and I read this and I went, oh yeah, of course you're an attorney. I mean, like, I read this, I was like, am I being sued? Like, the verbiage.
Well, why don't you read it to us?
To whom it may concern. Yeah, well, that already, I was like, I was this close to clicking delete when I saw that. I was like, yeah, another piece of spam. But no, he goes, my name is Joel Rose, and I am a labor attorney, albeit not one that works in the entertainment business. A friend forwarded me a link to one of your recent podcasts, wherein you discuss an ongoing dispute between the Writers Guild of America, and then in parentheses with little quotation marks, WGA and talent agency. So that little parentheses and
well,
quotation
that's
marks.
The sort of thing you do in contracts. It's just being careful, right, exactly, about who you're referring to. Keep going. Don't make fun of me. It's nice enough to write in. Keep going.
Okay. Well, okay. So he said, but the dispute between the Writers Guild of America and talent agencies. During the discussion, you raised the question and raised doubts whether the WGA would include deal points or clauses in their demands that their membership was unaware of, did not directly request, went against their historic trade behavior, or any combination thereof. I can inform you this routinely occurs. There are many reasons for this, leading with the logistics of returning to membership every time demands or deal points change is time-consuming and, in most cases, impossible. Other reasons to include demands outside the scope of membership knowledge or interest is to have points which can easily be sacrificed when working towards a compromise and needing to appear cooperative, mm-hmm. kind of like what you mentioned, Michael. Yeah. Hey, this is a negotiation. Finally, and yes, this does happen, there are times when a union may try to work in demands for clauses that have been long-term goals, even if the union benefits more from such deal points than the membership. Hmm. The example often cited for such demands is the very one that the WGA seems to be making with the talent agents, obtaining employment contracts for review and comparative purposes. The publication of contracts is a highly contentious and disputed topic, no matter the industry or trade. There are very good reasons employers wish to keep contracts confidential, which have nothing to do with taking advantage of employees. For instance, trade secrets, variability of benefits, etc. And there are similarly good reasons why unions wish to review and store employee contracts, for instance, tracking industry trends, access to historical deals, etc. The practice of revising contract demands is one reason that ratification of union contracts, joint agreements, and similar by a union membership is required. The ratification process gives the membership a chance to see exactly what demands and deal points are included at the base union level. I hope you find this information useful as the WGA and talent agents continue their negotiations. Kind regards, Joel Rose.
Well, there you go. So you could be high-fiving Joel Rose, I guess, as he takes me down a notch and says, well, there's lots of good reasons why the WGA would do this. The one I hadn't considered at all was the idea that they have goals and needs and desires different from their membership, things that they can benefit from that their members won't necessarily like in any way, shape, or form. Hadn't thought about that, hadn't considered that, and I appreciate your writing in and giving us your perspective.
You know, and I asked two WGA members, I said, hey, do you know about this clause 3 where you're supposed to you know, submit it, and it, is it really kind of held up? And they were like, "Ugh, this clause three thing." Like both of them
enough
kind of rolled
the clause
their
three.
Eyes. Yeah, and they were like, "Yeah, we know about it." You know, one of them said, "Yeah," and every once in a while, I'll send a contract in that you have to ask for it. He said, "Part of the problem is you have to ask the network or the studio for the guild draft, which kind of takes out some of the things that, you know, that particular writer might be getting that maybe other writers don't get, not base things like salary levels, but like, oh, you get a trailer or, oh, right, you get to come to the premiere, like little things like that." And he said, it's just, it's like one more, you know, he said, you know, writers can barely figure out how to cash a paycheck, let alone like get a guild draft. And I thought that was kind of funny. And one of them said, I was like, well, you know, by the way, tuck in your shirt.
Well, we got another letter. It's from a longtime friend of the show, Joe Gaze. He's in Wilmington, Delaware. Is that Delaware? DE?
Yes, it is.
He says, "Hey, kids, it's Joe, close friend of the show. On the last episode, there was a discussion about finding songs from a TV show or movie." That's right. I was complaining that the end credits listing all the music used in a film and TV show, they do not appear in any official databases like Wikipedia or IMDb. He goes on.
And I immediately started writing out my specifications for the website that we were going to build, Michael, that was going to make us $1 trillion and allow us to buy Bob Iger's old home.
Well, you can still do it. He says, "There is a place that tracks what tracks are played." He says, I'm sorry, Michael, for my attempt at a sprawling joke. But anyway, he says, The site TuneFind will help you know what song was just played. It's not perfect the night of a show, but nor is IMDb. He gave us a link to TuneFind.com, and he says, "Love the show," and signs it, "Thanks, Joe Gaze." So I appreciate that. I looked at TuneFind. It's okay. I think it's going to be okay if, like, you watch Riverdale and go the next day or two, you will find out what the big song used in the thing. But in terms of the end credits for lots of movies and the historic record, I don't think they're going to plug that gap. They don't seem to be doing it. When I looked up The Big Chill, all they did was link to the soundtrack and show you what songs were on the soundtrack. When I looked up a foreign film called The Sun's Room, which has some great music by Brian Eno and was a big popular film and a Cannes winner, that's not
Nanny Moretti.
Not even in the database. So I think it's going to be useful for that. You know, if you didn't have a chance to Shazam it, if you went there, you would find out what song was playing on Game of Thrones. Absolutely. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. But to do a database, you'd have to have some way of pulling that info from the film credits, you know, and it's such an image. So I don't know how you would do a program to read the film credits. But if you could read the film credits automatically and generate all that information, that's the only way we could do what I'm talking about here. So Sperling, write it away.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank both Joe and Joel. J names today for writing into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, they could have called and left us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter at showbizsandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Now that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to write to us, the ways to subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show. You can rate and review this show. It helps us out when you do that. It helps other people find the show when you do that. That website, showbizsandbox.com, that's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's grrr.com. That's my bad Wookiee.
How do you spell that?
My bad Wookiee.
How many R's in
that?
It's
a lot of R's, and Old Town Road is still number one, 5 weeks in a row.
Old Town Road. Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice. How cool is it, by the way, that I now have my own genre of comedy, Sperling jokes?
It's like Borscht Belt humor, Sperling jokes, Sperling schwitzers. I don't know what, we got to get a catchier phrase. Sperling jokes doesn't quite flow off the tongue. Sperling Zingers.
I've been faulted for having dad jokes, but I like Sperling jokes. That's pretty good.
That's much better, much more sophisticated.